From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Her father was a Broadway star, but she became famous for playing and singing the blues. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Bonnie Raitt. Also today, actor Kirk Douglas tells us how he kept comfortable when he was crucified in the film Spartacus. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the latest collection of previously unreleased material by Duke Ellington. And television critic David Bianculli reviews TV's latest look at the Jeffrey McDonald murder case. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. President Bush met with Polish officials today in Warsaw and addressed the Polish parliament. NPR's Jim Angle reports Bush offered some incentives for a speedy transition to a market economy.
President Bush has embraced and applauded political reforms already underway here, and he promised U.S. and Western assistance if they continue and spread to the economy. In toast at a dinner this evening, the president said Poland has surpassed all expectations, but he noted there is a long road ahead.
Reform is a difficult process, as you well know, and there are neither easy answers nor cost-free solutions, but there is a sound basis for hope. And today, you have the goodwill of an expectant and hopeful world.
The U.S. is part of that hopeful world, and the president wants to encourage a free market here. The president pledged $100 million to help develop the private sector in Poland. He also promised to press the Western allies to help reschedule part of Poland's $39 billion foreign debt, help he said that could defer payments of $5 billion this year alone. Tomorrow, the president travels to Gdańsk to visit the birthplace of Solidarity and to see its leader, Lech Wałęsa. I'm Jim Angle with the president in Warsaw.
The foreign minister of Hungary said today his country will not be seeking U.S. loans during the visit by President Bush, but the official said top leaders will press for trade concessions and easier technology transfer. Hungary is saddled with gross foreign debts of more than $17 billion. Black nationalist leader Nelson Mandela met with his wife Winnie today to talk about Nelson Mandela's recent discussions with President P.W. Botha. More from NPR's John Madison.
Mandela and his wife had a short meeting at the Victor Verster prison farm where Mandela lives in a prison house. They discussed the statement issued by the government about the Botha-Mandela meeting. Mandela confirmed to his wife that he did meet Botha last Wednesday. He said the government's statement about it was a fairly accurate reflection of what happened. But Mandela said he has submitted his own statement about the meeting to the prison authorities. He wants it to be published. Mandela's action has put the government in a dilemma. If it releases his statement, it will be giving him his first opportunity to communicate with his people in 25 years. But if it refuses, it risks forfeiting the propaganda coup that resulted from the meeting. I'm John Matheson in Johannesburg.
Mel Blanc died today in Los Angeles. Blank created the voice for a number of Warner Brothers cartoon characters, including Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and Porky Pig. Mel Blanc was 81. Stock prices were higher in light trading on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 14 points to close at 2502.65. Advances led declines 9-5 on volume of 133 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 22 cents. This is NPR News. Two explosions ripped one of Islam's holiest shrines in Mecca today. The Saudi press agency said the blasts occurred on a bridge and street leading to the holy mosque and caused some loss of life. An estimated 1.5 million Muslims from around the world are in Saudi Arabia for this year's annual pilgrimage, which ends Thursday. Iran is boycotting the pilgrimage to protest its assigned quota of pilgrims and a ban on demonstrations. During 1987's pilgrimage, more than 400 people, mostly Iranians, were killed when anti-Western demonstrations were put down by Saudi security forces. The nation's firefighting headquarters in Boise, Idaho, has issued extreme fire alerts for four Western states. Jill Hoyt reports from member station KBSU in Boise.
Eastern Idaho, Western Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado are now under red flag warnings, the highest state of alert, because of gusty winds, dry lightning storms, and hot temperatures. The Boise Interagency Fire Center is already tracking 44 out-of-control fires in 10 western states, using more than 11,000 firefighters. In Nebraska, they've called in the National Guard, where a nursing home, hospital, and state park have been evacuated. In Colorado, 41 structures burned down. Most of the fires are in hard-to-reach areas where it's tough to get people, equipment, and food. Many fires are in forests which haven't burned in decades. That means more fuel is available for bigger, hotter blazes. For National Public Radio, I'm Jill Hoyt in Boise, Idaho.
The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases said today the anti-AIDS drug AZT will be given for the first time to a group of pregnant women infected with AIDS. The women will be part of an experiment to determine if the drug can protect newborns from the disease. Institute Director Anthony Fauci said the experiment is an effort to find a way of treating one of the fastest-growing categories of AIDS patients. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. In the early 70s, Bonnie Raitt seemed like an unlikely person to popularize the blues. She was white, from a prosperous family, and she'd been to Radcliffe College. Her father is John Raitt, who starred on Broadway in The Pajama Game and Carousel. But Bonnie Raitt fell in love with the blues and learned to play slide guitar. She befriended blues singers Fred McDowell and Sippy Wallace and introduced their songs to her audiences. Raitt's repertoire extends beyond the blues. She sings material by contemporary singer-songwriters like Jackson Browne and John Hiatt. She writes her own songs and does rock and roll and ballads. I think it's fair to say her first two albums, Bonnie Raitt and Give It Up, were staples in the record collections of most college students in the early 70s. Even during periods when her record sales have been down, she's maintained an audience devoted to her singing and playing. Bonnie Raitt has a new album. It's called Nick of Time, and it's produced by Don Was of the band Was Not Was. From that album, this is Too Soon to Tell.
So now there's somebody new. These dreams I've been dreaming have all fallen through. You say I'll be fine. It only takes time.
Bonnie Raitt, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on the show. I love it.
Okay. I want to ask you a little bit about the new record. I sense this freedom on the record to sing in different styles, do different kinds of songs, blues, ballads, rock songs. Is that something that you always have on records?
It was especially my trademark in the beginning when I was first signed to Warner Brothers back in 71. My first three albums were pretty eclectic that way, and that's the way my musical taste runs, and I think my fans also. There was some criticism at some point when the records didn't sell that possibly that was because it was too eclectic and people couldn't categorize me, which, it's just the way it is. So I stayed with my loyal following and did what I wanted. People are always trying to figure out which direction I'm going to go in next, and I basically just have always played the same mix of rhythm and blues and country and folk and rock and jazz, and I wish radio was open to playing all those different categories also. And the reason this one is like that is because not only am I on a new label who supports that idea of encouraging me to do what I do best, which is probably eclectic stuff, but also the climate of radio, I think, has changed and is coming back around to appreciating roots music and different types of ethnic music. And let's hope there'll be a resurgence of blues and rhythm and blues.
Do you think your voice has changed since the early 70s when you started recording?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, I listen to that stuff and I can barely take it because I always wanted to sound like Etta James. And to me, even though I love Joni Mitchell, I was leaning too much towards that high, sweet kind of sound. And I really wanted to sound like I was, you know, right about like what I am now, which is a broad that's been playing music for 20 years. It's been playing clubs and concerts. And my voice is kind of gotten richer and thicker and, you know, a little huskier, and that's more the way I like to hear it. But I still don't spend a lot of time listening to myself, I'll tell you that.
Did you do things when you were younger to try to deepen your voice?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, just being a rock and roll and blues singer for all these years, you live a lifestyle that's got a lot of late nights and a lot of partying and all that, so I imagine that contributed to it. And I think just a certain amount of maturity, and I like to think that I play and sing better than I did when I was 21, and hopefully when I'm 60, I'll be playing better than now.
You've said that you once took singing lessons to try to protect your voice, but you stopped because you ended up sounding like Vicky Carr. I thought that was really funny.
Well, no, nothing against Vicky Carr either. I just, a lot of those singing teachers want you to sing more legitimate, and you end up doing scales that really are more suited for operatic or Broadway singing, and I kind of left it alone, although I think now as I get older, I'm going to be vocalizing more, even though my band laughs at me when I do it, but just to keep the muscles in the throat from being strained, and so you can sing through a cold. But most of all, I just recommend, being healthy, and I, you know, the things that would wear me down and dissipate me, I don't do anymore. So in general, I'm in a pretty good rejuvenated state, singing-wise and physically.
Your father, John Raitt, had a flourishing Broadway career, best known for his starring role in Pajama Game. Were you self-conscious when you started singing blues that your father was a Broadway star, since the two kinds of music are considered really opposite by a lot of people?
Yeah, it was pretty ironic, but I mean, our generation was growing up with folk music and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and I became a complete blues freak the minute I heard that kind of music, as I'm a big fan of Motown and Stax Vold and soul music. I just think it was a generational thing more than anything, and I certainly don't have my dad's incredible range of and volume of voice. I mean, he still continues to sing all the time. I just saw him in South Pacific last weekend, and you know, Carousel is another show that he created the starring role in, and continues to sing better than ever, and is a constant inspiration to me. But in terms of musical styles, he thought it was kind of odd that his, you know, 16, 17-year-old daughter was singing these kind of double entendre Sippy Wallace songs. So I think he's real proud of me that I've managed to stay in this as long as I have, and I'm proud of him for doing the same.
My guest is singer and guitarist Bonnie Raitt, and she has a new album called Nick of Time. I want to play the title song from this album, which is a song that you wrote. And before we hear it, I'd like to ask you if there was something in your life that led to the lyric.
Yeah, I was really inspired to write something that, you know, as an interpreter of other people's material, a lot of times I'm singing, whatever I choose to sing is something that I really believe in also, and something I'm going through at the same time usually. Jackson Brown's a good friend, and I like to sing his songs for that reason. And this particular tune, I just had a bunch of things on my mind that I hadn't heard anybody else say, and I said, well, I guess I'm going to have to get down and write another song, because it doesn't come easily for me. But a friend of mine was, in fact, like the first verse says, going through this situation, having to decide, as a lot of women our age, or my age anyway, are trying to decide whether to have children or whether their career still takes some more time to work on, or whether the two are in conflict with each other. And in this case, the man in her life isn't ready to have children, and she's got to decide because she's almost 40. So the poignancy of that situation was not lost on me, and that's basically on a long drive in my car one time, it just came to me. And the other verses about my parents getting older and consequently us looking at each other getting older, and just about the choices you make at this point in your life.
Well, this is the song Nick of Time. It's the title track from Bonnie Raitt's new album, and she's featured on vocals and piano.
Yeah.
Nick of Time from Bonnie Raitt's new album of the same name. How did you find the blues and rhythm and blues?
I basically loved soul music, and I also loved folk music. And when I heard that Blues at Newport in 63, when I was 13, which is an album on Vanguard, with Mississippi John Hurt and Brownie McGee, Sonny Terry, Dave Van Ronk, John Lee Hooker, John Hammond, that was the first time I'd actually heard blues, and I just went crazy. I had already been playing Joan Baez songs and Peter, Paul, and Mary songs, as was the whole country at the time in the early 60s, you know, going to peace marches and civil rights rallies and singing Times They Are Changing and all that. And when I heard this other offshoot coming out of the Newport Folk Festival, which was blues, I then tried to get my hands on every record I could and just sat in my room and learned everything I could until I never really planned to do this for a living. And when I was in college back in the East, it became a kind of an oddity that I was playing Robert Johnson songs. So the next thing I knew, I was getting gigs in little clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of fell into it because it was an oddity for a young white girl to be playing that kind of music.
Well, exactly. And I was wondering if you ever had an authenticity crisis, you know, as a white middle class woman who's the daughter of a Broadway star. Did people ever say, "How, you know, do you have the right to sing the blues?"
Hey, I ask the guys I go out with. you know, blues doesn't, you don't have to be white or poor or colored or black or green or whatever. You know, it's just this, that stuff is a constant. I think that blues music needs to be appreciated in its original form, and I had the honor of working with a lot of the great Delta players and Chicago players who did not get recognized while they were alive, and even now the ones that are still touring should be much bigger stars than they are. So I think there's no problem with people doing each other's music as long as you give credit where credit is due. And basically, whether I'm authentic enough is up to somebody that wants to decide whether they spend money to come and see me. I've always wanted to, I've been a big fan of this music for a long time, and I play it because I really just have to play it. I love it, and I never asked anybody to like my version of it, and then when they did, I've been lucky enough to get away with it for 20 years.
When you first started singing blues and traveling on the road performing, did you try on the part of blues mama, and were there certain affectations you took on when you were younger that you later gave up, realizing that you didn't have to do that?
Well, I wouldn't call them affectations. I mean, I romanticized rock and roll and blues as a lifestyle, as did many of the other people that went into music, just the way book writers feel like they have to be tortured souls, and they also have a tendency to drink too much, and so do rock and rollers who party too much. And I chose this lifestyle because I really loved it, and I had a great time in my 20s and early 30s staying up late and partying with my friends, and because I got my work done. I mean, it wasn't excessive. It wasn't really driving me. And then recently, since I'm 39 now, in the last couple of years, I decided I want to feel better and look better and sing better. And that kind of lifestyle can be kind of debilitating spiritually and emotionally as well as physically and creatively. So I'm happily sober and healthy, and doesn't seem to affect anything other than the fact that I feel great. You know, I mean, it doesn't change my music. I didn't become a Mooney. I didn't stop being funky or anything. It's just one of the things that my generation of rock and rollers and folk singers and blues singers has learned from losing a lot of our friends from this lifestyle is that at 36 or 37, you've got to cool it. So it's something I'm real happy to have gotten out of my system, and I don't miss it, and I think it's going to allow me to be able to do this for another 30 or 40 years, I hope.
I want to talk with you more about your music, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is singer and guitarist and songwriter Bonnie Raitt, and we'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Singer, guitarist, and songwriter Bonnie Raitt is my guest. You've sung a lot of double entendre type of blues songs over the years. And when you started singing them in the early 70s, it was just the time when a lot of women were really discovering feminism and being very firm in the idea that they didn't want to be sexual objects in men's eyes. And I wonder what it was like for you to be discovering these blues songs and sexual double entendre songs at the same time that you were probably also discovering feminism.
Well, if you'll notice, the songs that I do, especially the Sippy Wallace tunes, they are precisely about being, you know, about being sexual and expecting sexual parity and not be, you know, justice is what it's about. You know, you can sing about justice in Central America and you can sing about justice in a relationship. And most of the songs I sing are, if you don't treat me right, get the hell out of here, you know, or you can make me do what you want to do, but you better know how. And, you know, I got a lot of flack for singing Sippy's Women Be Wise song, which has a lyric, women be wise, keep your mouth shut, don't advertise your man. Some women these days, they ain't no good, you know, and basically the tone of the song is that, you know, if your old man knows how to do something great to you, don't brag about him because somebody else is going to check him out. And at the time, there was all this talk of sisterhood and nobody should ever, you know, try to steal each other's man. And the fact is that that's been going on since the beginning of time, whether we like it or not. And it was, you know, done with a sense of humor. And it's a little wink and a little nudge and a sexual battleground or the playground, however you choose to look at it, is something that should be, you should sing about from all the different angles of it. And I caught a little flack from gay women and feminist women in the beginning, but it's all contained in my estimation of myself is that I'm not going to take any undue grief from anybody, especially not anymore. And, you know, you try to be as playful and as strong at the same time. And all these songs that I sing, if you take them as a whole, they project a pretty strong yet vulnerable impression. And that's the one I think is the one I feel, and I think a lot of women do also. But it was awkward at the time. But I think the double entendre part of it is just a celebration of sexuality. Nothing wrong with that.
I want to play one of those double entendre songs, and this is from the second album that you made, from Give It Up. And this is a Sippy Wallace song called Gotta Know How. That's Bonnie Raitt, her second album from, what is it, around 1973?
72.
72,
well,
yeah.
Takes me back. Well, I have to sit here with a big grin on my face, listening to that and remembering all the things that were going on at the time. That's a great thing about being able to do this over a long period of time, is each record is like a time capsule for me of the musicians I played with and what was going on.
The song that we just heard was written by Sippy Wallace, who you had befriended, and you sang a lot of her songs and recorded a record with her, and you were really responsible for bringing her into prominence again. Was she something of a role model for you? Was it important for you to find a woman who had sung the blues?
Yeah, Sippy's songs were different than some of the other classic blues songs of the period, because she was not a victim. I mean, her songs were really strong, and she was, you know, asking the guys that she was singing to treat her right. And it basically wasn't, you know, beat me up and I'll still love you kind of a thing. And I just liked her attitude, and I liked her humor, and I liked her sassiness, and had no idea she was still alive when I recorded those songs. And when I found out she was alive and living in Detroit, when they asked me to play the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival back in 72, I asked her to come out and meet me, and asked her if she would sing a song. And initially she only would do a gospel song, she said, because like a lot of older blues people, there's a schism between singing the blues, which is the devil's music in some people's minds, and then singing gospel music as you get older and you're trying to make peace with God for all the stuff you did when you were younger. And she got in the trailer and was just sort of, I started singing Women Be Wise, and my clarinetist was playing, and she started rocking back and forth and said, well, maybe I could just do one or two, you know. So it ended up being the beginning of a new career for her, and a very close friendship until she passed away a couple of years ago. I miss her a lot and sing songs and feel her presence all the time when I sing her stuff.
Mm-hmm. You sing a lot of ballads, and it really always sounds like you're putting your heart and soul into it when you're singing a song about heartbreak. And I guess I'm wondering if it's exhausting to put yourself through that. You seem to really get emotionally involved in those songs.
Yeah, I'll tell you, if I did ballads all the time, I would probably slip my wrist at the end of the show. But that's why, that's why you mix it up a little bit. I don't think the audience wants to hear too many sad songs in a row. I've accidentally put a string of things together that have made me end up not being able to go on for a minute and have to take a little break. There's certain songs like River of Tears, which is an Eric Kaz song from the Green Light album that I sang with Richard Manuel from the band. And at night, when I sing it, I dedicate it to Lowell George and Paul Butterfield and Richard and Jesse Ed Davis and Roy Buchanan and a bunch of friends of mine that I've lost from rock and roll living. And sometimes if I sing that and stay too long at the fair and song about the Midway in a row, I'm done myself in. So that's when it's time to reel out something funky, you know, kick it up a little bit. And I think that's why people play music. They get inspired both ways, mm-hmm. to go on and to have their heart broken again.
Bonnie Raitt is my guest, and we only have about a minute left. So I just want to ask you about being on the road. A song that you wrote for your new album is called The Road's My Middle Name. Is it going to be hard for you staying on the road, having given up some of the alcohol and late nights and things that you were talking about before? It seems that the road leads to that so easily.
Well, I've been doing it for a couple of years now, and it's, if anything, it just makes it really fun for me to be able to have a bunch of extra hours and do different things. Like I said, I enjoyed it while I was doing it. I'm enjoying not doing it. I had enough. I'm looking forward to doing this like Sippy. I mean, Sippy was 88 when she died. My dad's 72 now and going strong. And one of the great things about not being a sex goddess is that people listen to what I sing and not what I look, and don't care so much what I look like. So I guess I'll be able to, more gracefully than others, being an instrumentalist and an interpreter of other people's material, and blues and jazz being accepted when you're 66 years old or whatever, a little bit more easily than rock and roll. It'll be interesting to see how many of us survive, and it isn't difficult at all. It's just, it feels great. I really love my job, and I feel very lucky to be able to keep doing it.
Bonnie Raitt, thanks so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Bonnie Raitt's new album is called Nick of Time. She's currently on tour and will perform in Park City, Utah on July 12th, in San Jose, California on July 28th, and in Sacramento on July 30th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Friday is Bastille Day, and on the next Fresh Air, I'll speak with historian Simon Chama about the French Revolution. Chama's new book, Citizens, is a revisionist history of the revolution. Well, here's Bonnie Raitt with a single from her latest album, This Is Thing Called Love.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're listening to some previously unreleased music by the late Duke Ellington from a series called Duke Ellington's Private Collection. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the latest volumes in the series. Also, we meet the actor who was the young man with a horn, the slave leader Spartacus, and the diver who wrestled with a giant squid 20,000 leagues under the sea, Kirk Douglas. And television critic David Bianculli reviews False Witness. It's a syndicated TV special that re-examines the facts surrounding the Jeffrey McDonald murder case. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News, I'm Doreen McAllister. Poland's communist leadership and opposition solidarity movement are giving mixed reactions to an offer from President Bush for $100 million in aid to the East Bloc country. Bush told the first joint session of the new parliament in Warsaw that economic reform will be a historic challenge, but that the United States is ready to help. Some of the sites the president visited during his two-day visit have struck a sensitive chord with the Polish people. One of those is the Warsaw Ghetto, which 300,000 Jews passed through on their way to death camps during World War II. Jane Dobia reports.
President Bush laid flowers near a wall in the ghetto that bears the name of 400 victims of Nazi war crimes. This country was the site of the majority of death camps during the war. For the Polish people, that is a painful and as yet unresolved part of their history. Marek Edelman, the last surviving leader of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, accompanied Bush today. He reminded the president that rich America must sometimes give up a chunk of its wealth so the world can be free, so that these things do not happen again. Tomorrow, Bush will visit a monument to the victims of another more recent massacre. In Gdańsk, he'll lay flowers at three tall anchored crosses that honor workers who were killed by government forces in 1970. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Officials say a British Airways Boeing 747 made an unscheduled landing in Frankfurt, West Germany today after a reported bomb threat. A British official's airway says no explosives were found during the search and the plane continued on to London. The plane had left the Bombay area with 287 people on board. No other details were given. The Senate Impeachment Committee today began hearings into the impeachment trial of U.S. District Judge Elsie Hastings of Florida. Hastings, the first black federal judge in the state, was impeached by the House last year. Tony Randolph has more.
Both sides presented their opening arguments this morning. The prosecution says it will prove Hastings lied under oath during his 1983 trial, in which he was acquitted by a jury of bribery charges. Hastings' case involves a Washington attorney and an alleged conspiracy for Hastings to accept a $150,000 bribe in exchange for reducing the sentences of two convicted racketeers. Despite his acquittal, most of the 17 impeachment articles against Hastings stem from that trial. Terrence Anderson, Hastings' attorney, says the judge is being harassed by the FBI. A dozen senators will hear the evidence and make a recommendation to the full Senate. The entire Senate will then listen to the closing arguments before voting on impeachment. For National Public Radio, I'm Tony Randolph in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 14.80 points today to 2502.66. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. The composer Duke Ellington used to say he kept his band on call so that he could hear the next day music he'd written the night before. He'd also use such studio dates to rehearse old favorites or try out some new approach he'd been contemplating. Most of the music from those impromptu sessions went unheard until 2 years ago when 5 albums of material from Ellington's private collection were issued. 5 more albums are out now, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Say that volumes 6 through 10 of the Ellington Private Collection don't match the brilliance of the first 5 is no major put-down. The first batch was stunning. If you love Ellington and you don't have them, what are you thinking about? This music is fascinating for the same reasons great writers' notebooks or great film directors' outtakes are. They reveal the mind of the artist at work. There's some first-rate stuff in this series, including splendid features for Duke's great soloists. But it's also fascinating to hear Ellington toying with different ideas that were in the air in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
That's Riva, a 1968 recording from Volume 9 of the Private Collection. The richly voiced saxophone harmonies are typically Ellingtonian, but the way those chords sway back and forth without going anywhere is not. On Riva, Duke explores the open-ended structures in vogue since modal jazz hit the scene in the late 50s. But Ellington was too fond of shifting harmonies to find much he could use in such static structures, and pieces like this were rare. Which makes it all the more strange that in the 60s, Ellington flirted with another harmonically simple trend, rock music. Scattered through volumes 7, 8, and 9 are pieces like the four-chord trifle, When I'm Feeling Kind of Blue, written by Joe Villasenor and arranged by her husband, jazz trumpeter Gerald Wilson. The alto saxophonist is Johnny Hodges. In the 60s, when business was bad for jazz, a lot of musicians took the British invasion as a personal insult. But Ellington seemed intent on slicing a piece of the rock pie for himself. This led him to concoct a few harmless big beat instrumentals, and this 1968 absurdity sung by Trish Turner.
If you want to make a hit with me, like the ultra aristocracy, if you want to be the B2B, be cool and groovy for me. If you want to, you may ABC. When you're pretty, you may XYZ. When you're lucky and get 1, 2, 3, be cool and groovy for me. We'll jump.
They could have done that one on Shindig. Jazz critics often decry any musician who shows commercial inclinations, so it's worth remembering that even the great Ellington kept an eye on the market once in a while. But critics are also right to observe that commercial instincts rarely bring out a musician's best. In any case, Duke proved time and again that he could write tunes that were pretty and simple at the same time, like Rod LaRock, named for a suave silent film star. The Ellington Private Collection is on the Saggio label, distributed by Atlantic. The 10 volumes are available only on CD and cassette. The CDs run over an hour. The cassette issues are missing a few tracks and lack the essential liner notes by Ellington chronicler and series compiler Stanley Dance. Through no fault of Dance, both versions have some incorrect recording dates and composer credits, unclear personnel listings, and even mistitled pieces. Music this important deserves documentation to match. Volume 6 of the Private Collection, a 1958 concert recording, is the least impressive of the new bunch. Volume 10, which contains a new edition of the suite Black, Brown, and Beige, is the most significant. I'll tell you about that next time.
Given Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence, he played music from Volume 7, 8, and 9 of Duke Ellington, the Private Collection. They're on the Sodja record label, distributed by Atlantic. This is Fresh Air. One of Hollywood's biggest stars of the 1950s and 60s also had one of the most distinctive voices in film. My guest Kirk Douglas starred in the movies Champion, 7 Days in May, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Lust for Life, Paths of Glory, Spartacus, Gunfight at the OK Corral, and Tough Guys. Douglas is the son of poor, illiterate Russian-Jewish immigrants. He writes about his life on and off the screen in his autobiography, The Ragman's Son, which is just out in paperback. In his book, Douglas talks about how he formed his own production company. He was one of the first actors in Hollywood to strike out on his own. His son, Michael, has followed in his father's footsteps as an actor and producer. I asked Kirk Douglas why he started producing his own films.
I wanted a production company so that I could find something that I wanted to do and then try to develop it. And sometimes I was very successful at doing that. Spartacus, Paths of Glory, but sometimes I was very unsuccessful, as when I bought One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and had it for 10 years and shopped it all over town and nobody wanted to do it until my son Michael said, look, Dad, let's be partners. Let me see if I can get the money. And he went outside of the industry and got the money, and the rest is history.
I want to talk to you a little bit about the film Spartacus, in which you both starred and produced. You ended up casting Gene Simmons in the role of Spartacus's lover and the woman who he has a baby with. And initially you didn't want to cast her because she's British, and you thought that that would ruin the linguistic pattern of the movie. And I'd love for you to explain what you meant by that.
Well, I have a very simple... For example, when I did the Vikings, all the Vikings are Americans. We have a rougher pattern of speech. The English have a more elegant pattern of speech. So that makes it work. In Spartacus, you'll notice that all the aristocratic Romans are English.
That's right. They're great, the slaves, great stage actors, great British stage actors.
The slaves, like myself, were Americans.
Not only that, ethnic, right? Jewish, Italian.
You see, it's just that Americans have a rougher speech pattern. For example, I often think that Shakespeare very often is better played in one is done in the United States, because those beautiful lines take on a rougher quality that I think Shakespeare really intended it.
So the slaves have the rough quality, and that's the Romans right. have the more genteel, educated, refined
exactly.
sound.
Exactly. Of course.
Was this intentional? Is this standard, or is this just something you wanted to do? Do you think it's pretty standard in epics of that period to cast that way?
I don't know. I never thought of it that way. It was just, you know, my way of looking at the picture. And of course, Spartacus, you picked on a picture that plays a big section in my book, because so much happened during the making of Spartacus. The most historical event was the breaking of the blacklist. And that's one of the reasons that Spartacus is so important to me.
Well, that's right. Well, Dalton Trumbo was writing it under a pseudonym, like he was writing all of his screenplays at the time, because he was blacklisted. And you insisted that for this movie he actually use his real name. Did you think that the time was right where you could say, this is Dalton Trumbo who wrote the movie, and where it would actually be accepted, that the time was right to break the blacklisting and have it be accepted, at least in part of Hollywood?
Well, I'm not so sure. I did it rather impulsively. I don't think I was aware until a couple years later, as I reflected upon it, and like, you know, as I explain in my book, I began to see, you know, the significance of it. What bothered me when I did Spartacus was the hypocrisy in Hollywood, that these people, some of them who spent a year in jail for a crime that was never very clearly stated, I mean, were denied denied using their talents except behind the scenes. Studio heads would look the other way while a lot of these unfriendly 10 writers would be writing scripts for very little money. So it was so hypocritical that it annoyed me to the extent that I said, well, what happens? We had a discussion of whose name are we going to put on the screen of Spartacus. And suddenly I said, well, what happens if I put Dalton Trumbo's name on? And they said, oh, Kirk, you're bound. They said, you know, you're going to get out of the business and all that. I said, no, the hell with it. I'm going to do it. And the next day I left the pass. Dalton Trumbo hadn't been on a set in 10 years. I left the pass for Dalton Trumbo. No Sam Jackson. Of course, even Sam Jackson, we wouldn't have allowed on the set, somebody might have recognized him as Dalton Trumbo.
That was his pen name for this movie.
Yes, and from then on, I mean, I'll never forget when Dalton Trumbo walked on the set, came over to me and says, Kirk, thanks for giving me back my name. There were people who, I got letters from different organizations, had a hopper attack me, but the sky didn't fall in. And after that, a few months after that, Otto Preminger announced that Dalton Trumbo was going to be writing this script, and the blacklist was broken.
Since we're talking about Spartacus, let me play a clip from the movie. And this is toward the end of the first half of the film. Remember, this movie had an intermission. And Spartacus and many other slaves have escaped from slavery. And after they've escaped, many of the slaves are just drinking wine. They're having Romans fight each other as if the Romans were slaves. And Spartacus is saying, what are you doing with your lives? You should be doing something more productive. And he suggests that they actually fight the Roman Empire.
What are we, Crixus? What are we becoming, Romans? We look for wine when we should be hunting bread.
When you've got wine, you don't need bread.
We can't just be a gang of drunken raiders.
What else can we be?
Gladiators. An army of gladiators.
Well, they get their army, and you, as Spartacus, lead them against the Roman army. You know the scene where the slave army gets started by burning logs in front of the army, and then they roll the logs down the hill. So these flaming logs force the Roman army to retreat. And you see in the movie a lot of Roman soldiers getting burned by these logs. How'd you do that?
Well, listen, those are the scenes. We don't discuss how we do. You don't have a magician telling you how you do a trick. That was a very effective device that we had a very talented director, Stanley Kubrick. Who was doing it. But that in itself is not a very difficult thing to shoot, to have burning logs rolling into soldiers. But it was very effective.
There is a scene at the end that is a mass crucifixion, and you're one of the many actors on the cross at the end of the movie. And I'd really like to know how you were attached to the cross so that you could hang there without really hurting yourself.
Well, as a matter of fact, playing that scene, we learned an awful lot about crucifixion. We learned that it would be impossible to be crucified the way very often you see a crucifixion. You know, the body would sag right down. But to make our scenes effective, it was very easy. Every cross had a bicycle seat that just kept the body up high enough so that you wouldn't be sagging down in a very unattractive position.
Okay, so that's the secret. You quote your wife in your book, who once said to you, it's an unnatural life just being wrapped up in make-believe characters. You've played so many different characters through the course of your career. Were you ever confused about who you really were as opposed to who the characters you played were?
Well, the only time I encountered something similar to that was in playing Lust for Life. Van Gogh really was a painful character to play, and it was so easy to study his character because there's a whole book of letters that he wrote to his brother. And reading those letters, you could understand him so perfectly. And shooting the picture, we shot it in Auvers-sur-Oise and Arles, Les Baux, all the places that Van Gogh lived. And when I came to the town of Auvers-sur-Oise, where Van Gogh died, and I had this stubby red beard and kinky red hair in the outfit, a lot of the old-timers, they said, il est retourné. They actually felt as if Van Gogh had come back. So there was an amazing resemblance that I must have had to Van Gogh, and that all affected me. And the poignancy of that role did really get to me, and it destroyed my original concepts of what acting is all about, where you're supposed to have the discipline of knowing that this is make-believe. And I never watched Lust for Life until about 6 months after it was finished. I just didn't want to even be close to it. It was a painful experience.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something about you physically in terms of your acting. People think of you, they think of your voice. Physically, they really think of the dimple in your chin. And when you started acting, was there ever a time where that was seen as a disadvantage? Did anyone ever try to cover that up with makeup?
Oh, yeah. The first time I came to Hollywood, you know, and they're looking at this Broadway actor, there was talk of... And they did. They filled it up with putty.
Really?
It had to be an awful lot of putty because I don't have a dimple in my chin. I have a hole in my chin. And it annoyed me. I said, look, I just pushed the putty out. I said, look, this is what you get if you want it. I'm not going to change it. So let me know if this is what you want or I'm going back to New York. And that was the end. I mean, and since then, I've never, you know, it's a part of me.
Kirk Douglas. His autobiography, The Ragman's Son, is now out in paperback. Here's a scene from one of his many films, Young Man with a Horn. Here's Kirk Douglas with Doris Day and Lauren Bacall.
I want you to meet an old friend of mine, Amy North. This is Rick Martin.
Hello. It isn't there anymore.
Oh, what?
The expression on your face, your whole mood. When you were playing that trumpet, you were exalted, sure of yourself. Now you've undergone a rather startling transition, Richard. I'd rather call you Richard than Rick. You don't mind.
Well,
people try to find security in a lot of strange ways. You seem to have solved your problems, at least while you're playing that trumpet.
I don't understand a word you're saying, but I love the sound of your voice. You got a wonderful rough spot in it.
I should have warned you about Amy. She always talks like a medical book and likes to analyze everything. She's studying to be a doctor, Rick, a psychiatrist.
Oh, well, how do I...
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Linda, how are you covering the president's trip to Poland?
Terry, we've sent our White House correspondent along with the president, and of course we have Jane Dobia, who reports for us from Warsaw, and they will both be on the program tonight. Part of the $100 million aid package that the president announced today from Poland is designated to deal with clean air and clean water, which is a very big problem in some parts of Poland, and we're going to take a look at how big a problem unregulated environmental pollution can be. We also will be hearing, we'll have reports from Israel, we'll have reports from South Africa, and the Denver Nuggets have been sold, so we'll talk about that.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of television's most popular miniseries was NBC's Fatal Vision. It dramatized author Joe McGinnis's account of the Jeffrey McDonald murder trial. This week, a nationally syndicated TV documentary reinvestigates that famous case, and television critic David Bianculli has this review.
Jeffrey McDonald, physician and former Green Beret, is in prison right now, serving three consecutive life sentences for the murders of his wife Colette and his young daughters Kimberly and Christy. McDonald, who suffered a punctured lung and a few cuts the same night his wife and daughters were stabbed to death, said then, and still says today, that his family was attacked by Manson-style hippies. The jury thought otherwise, but this week's TV special, False Witness, lets McDonald tell his side once again.
I simultaneously heard Colette screaming and I heard my daughter screaming. I saw one black male and two white males. And I couldn't figure out what was going on.
Then he claims he saw a girl wearing shiny boots. She talked in a strange monotone.
What I heard was, acid is groovy, kill the pigs. And I believe I heard that twice at first. That was the first thing that I remember hearing. But it's very jumbled because that's mixed up with my wife screaming, Jeff, help me.
The rest of False Witness examines evidence not admitted in court and interviews the surviving witnesses, experts, and investigators. The obvious inspiration for all this is The Thin Blue Line, the documentary that re-examined a murder case and did such a good job of detective work that the convicted murderer was ultimately exonerated. But the McDonald case isn't so easily refuted. The most damning piece of evidence is McDonald's pajama top, which was found full of puncture holes from an ice pick. McDonald testified that the holes were caused as he held the pajama top between his hands while fending off an attacker who had a knife. Afterwards, McDonald said, he covered his wife's bloody body with the pajama top. Forensic examination, though, found that the holes in the top were perfectly round, not torn, and that 21 of the holes matched identical puncture wounds on his wife's body. False Witness recreates the prosecution's dramatic demonstration, which put holes, so to speak, in McDonald's version of events.
If I could, I'd like to stand in front of you and placing great trust in Mr. Blackburn, I'm going to ask him to flail away at me with an ice pick.
It's a very persuasive demonstration. It also happens to have been one of the most memorable scenes from 1984's Fatal Vision, which used different actors to dramatize the same courtroom testimony.
If I could, I would like to stand in front of you and placing great trust in Mr. Blackburn, I'm going to ask him to flail away at me with an ice pick.
When something is a recreation of a recreation, you know you're not covering new ground. Most of the unfamiliar facts and theories False Witness does introduce are in McDonald's favor. Even so, the most the program asks its viewers is to decide whether there was a reasonable doubt of McDonald's guilt. And the program literally asks, with a pair of 900 phone numbers by which viewers can register their votes, at 75 cents a pop. I'm going to save my money and vote now. Even after watching False Witness, I'm convinced that Jeff McDonald is guilty of murdering his wife and children. And the most I can do is vote maybe on whether anyone should take the time to watch this show. If you're especially interested, go ahead. But whatever your opinion is going in, don't expect to have it changed.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, Audrey Voblaitis, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, just in time for the 200th anniversary of Bastille Day, historian Simon Schama talks about the causes and the legacy of the French Revolution. And we meet Rick Bass, probably the only writer who's been published in the Paris Review and has spent years looking for oil. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.